content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin today's program with an article from the April and May issue of Smithsonian titled Shattered by Jocelyn C. Zuckerman, The Youngest Victims of Belgian Rule. In its African colonies, Belgium forced thousands of mixed-race children into orphanages. Decades later, they are still seeking justice. The criminal abuse that King Leopold II of Belgium notoriously visited upon the people of the Congo River Basin. Beginning with his illicit appropriation in the 1880s of the vast territory he called the Congo Free State, did not end after he ceded control of the colony to the Belgian Parliament in 1908. For many more decades, brutal apartheid existed in the Belgian Congo and adjacent colonies. Belgium also gained the territory known as Ruanda-Urundi, corresponding to the present-day republics of Rwanda and Burundi, and this forced segregation gave rise to an especially heinous policy that is only now coming fully into view. Marriage between white and black people was made impossible by colonial administrators. Children of mixed-race parentage were not officially recognized by the state, which depended upon clear hierarchies and distinctions of race. While those who had been acknowledged by their European fathers or mothers were allowed to live with their families, the disavowed children were registered as members of the quote-unquote civilized native population, placing them under the guardianship of the state. The children were taken young, in some cases as soon as they could go to the bathroom on their own. African parents who refused to release their toddlers were threatened with reprisals, including jail time. Many of the abducted children would never see either parent again. Estimates vary, but the number of young people affected by this colonial policy, which officially ended in the 1960s, is certainly in the many thousands. Monique Bitu Bingi remembers all too clearly the final time the tall white man showed up in her village. The year was 1953, and she was living with her mother, grandparents, aunts, and uncles in a scattering of mud and thatch huts in the Kasai region of what was then the Belgian Congo. They had all seen the man before. He showed up periodically to check on the cotton plantings that each household was required to cultivate. On this occasion, he spoke with one of her uncles, and later on, back at her grandparents' hut. The four-year-old noticed that a grim mood had descended over the grown-ups. She lay down to sleep beside her grandmother, her mother having disappeared from the compound. The next thing Bitu Bingi remembers is waking by a large river. Her uncle helped her into a long, narrow canoe. After she and her grandmother, aunt, and uncle disembarked on the opposite shore, the four of them walked for 3 days, the adults taking turns carrying little Monique. At night, they bedded down in huts that villagers had built for storing cotton. Eventually, they came to a hospital, where the tall Belgian stood waiting by his truck. Some men lifted a cot holding a lifeless child into the back of it, and her aunt and uncle climbed up too, settling in amid the bales of cotton. Bitu Bingi and her grandmother were instructed to sit up front. She recalls waking a second time in the middle of a festival, surrounded by a crowd of people dancing. It must have been a Wednesday. That was the traditional day for a wedding. She searched the faces of the revelers but didn't recognize a soul. Eventually, a girl a few years older than she approached, holding a mango in her outstretched hand. Taking young Monique by the arm, she led her to a place where women in long white dresses with billowing white fabric framing their pale faces wandered among large buildings. A clutch of girls with brown skin similar to Bitu Bingi's own began to gather around her. It was another world, she said. I was somewhere else, and I didn't know anyone. It is only recently that Bitu Bingi and others of mixed race, who are known as mulâtres, from the Latin word mulus, the offspring of a horse and a donkey, have begun to speak publicly about how they were abducted from their homes as toddlers and installed in religious schools by the Belgian state. I first learned about these injustices in the course of my reporting on the palm oil industry for a recent book. The commodity was central to the economy of the Congo under colonial rule, and the same racist mindset underpinned the cultivation of the oil palm crop, which relied on forced labor. Like Bitu Bingi, Simone Ngalula was taken to Katende Mission, arriving in 1952 when she was just 3. Lea Tavares Muyinga, around 10 years old at the time, remembers well when Ngalula was dropped off with her 2 brothers by her grandfather. The siblings' Belgian dad had been sent back home by the government, and her Congolese mother had been told that her husband had died. "I grew up thinking my father was dead," Ngalula said. "They told us that our father was the state, Papa l'État." Tavares Muyinga was not yet 3 years old when she was taken to Katende. However, in 1953, as one of the oldest of the 20 or so Métis, the term used today to describe these mixed-race girls, she was charged with helping take care of the new kids. I met with both women in Tavares' Muyinga's home, located in a modest housing complex in Brussels. Tavares Muyinga, 79, recalled how she'd seen the sisters of St. Vincent de Paul take the girls' shoes and socks, as they had done with other new arrivals, and issue them simple dresses in a rough fabric. Métis boys were overseen by priests in a separate facility. Meals consisted of sweet potato greens and the cassava mush known as fufu. Tavares Muyinga still bears scars on her legs from the ulcers that resulted from the lack of vitamins in her diet. A square-shaped recess on her forehead memorializes a particularly forceful smack from a nun she received when she was 5. Each girl was given a single blanket and slept on a thin mat. Bitu Bingi's was located next to a door, on the other side of which was a morgue. That explained the tiny still body that had been loaded onto the truck the day she had been dropped off. Once a week, the girls bathed in a river. Only to and from church on Sundays and at Christmas and Easter, or when one of the state agents was scheduled to come by to pay the nuns, where they issued socks and shoes. When the nuns ran out of drinking water, even if late at night, the girls would be summoned to walk the 3 miles to the river, balancing sloshing 5-gallon pots on their heads for the duration of the return trek. Among their other tasks was taking care of infants in the adjacent nursery, which the nuns had established in response to the many local women who died in childbirth. The girls would wash, change, and feed the babies every morning, afternoon, and evening, running to attend classes in between. None of the Métis girls had been baptized, nor were they invited to receive communion. "We were told we were the children of sin," Bitu Bingi says. "The sisters, the population, everyone called us that." In June 1960, the Belgian Congo was granted independence, but factional fighting had already begun to break out in the countryside. Toward the end of that year, a minibus pulled into the Katende compound, and the girls, having overheard talk of the worrisome political situation, assumed they were being flown out to Europe with the nuns. "We thought we were going to Belgium," recalled Bitu Bingi, "that Papa l'État was going to take us and be in charge along with our mother, Belgian Queen Fabiola. Oh la la, we were proud. I thought, I'm going to eat cakes every day." They boarded the bus, which drove as far as a town called Lusambo, across a river from the airport. There the girls watched as some of the women climbed into a long canoe, dismounted on the other side, and then proceeded to board the waiting plane. A priest informed the children that there wouldn't be room for everyone after all. They would be returning to Katende. Weeks later, said Bitubingi, five trucks bearing the insignia of the United Nations pulled into their compound late at night. The clergymen and the remaining nuns filed toward the vehicles with their suitcases, and they all drove hastily away. Left behind were nine Matisse girls and 20 or so of the newborn orphans. For 3 months, the girls survived on fruit, mushrooms, and whatever they scrounged up around the mission. Most nights, they would be jostled awake by wild-eyed combatants brandishing the hands of their fallen enemies. This particular ritual had deep roots in the region. Under King Leopold, state agents were required to cut the right hands from the Congolese they had murdered, as proof of both the number dead and that the king's precious bullets had not gone to waste. They forced the girls to watch as they dumped the bloody trophies, sometimes as many as 50 or 60 of them, into a nearby ditch. Enemies captured alive would be marched down to the river and shot, their corpses left to float downstream. "We saw many, many dead bodies," says Bitubingi. Eventually, police officers arrived, having been sent to protect the children. At night, they would order the girls to lie in the dirt and spread their legs. "We'll show you how babies are made," they would say, penetrating the prepubescent girls with long candles. When a local administrator learned that the girls were being abused, he divided them among some families nearby. Most were reasonably well taken care of, but there were some reports of sexual assault by guardians during those months after Katende. In mid-1961, Bitubingi managed to hitch a ride back to Katende with a truck full of soldiers hopped up for war. They settled her into the flatbed along their machetes, spears, and arrows. At the mission, she ran around grabbing sugar, dried fish, and salt, whatever she could get her hands on, then stopped to check on the abandoned orphans. "I went to look for them," she said. She found graves. This one was dead and this one was dead. Three quarters of them were dead. A local woman came to look after the babies who survived. A few days later, Bitubingi flagged the soldiers down for a ride back and was hoisted onto a flatbed, now pulsing with the grisly aftermath of the fight. "Between the disembodied arms and legs and the bloody hands," she said, "I didn't know where to look." It was in the years after World War I that Belgium gained control of the territory known as Ruanda-Urundi, which became the independent countries of Rwanda and Burundi in 1962. There, the Métis children, as wards of the state, were marched onto airplanes and flown to Belgium for placement with foster families or in orphanages. From the beginning of its time in the region, the colonial power favored members of the Tutsi tribe over those of the more numerous Hutus. The Europeans' preference for Tutsi women was evident in the Métis population, the majority of which tended to be of Tutsi ancestry. In large part because of the Belgians' discrimination, tribal tensions in the region had been rising since the mid-1950s, with Tutsis already beginning to be murdered. On the eve of independence, the state agreed to evacuate the children on grounds of escalating violence in the region. Jacquie Gougebert was just 5 months old when her Belgian father died of a heart attack. She has a single photo of him holding a zebra. Colonial officials moved Gougebert's six-year-old brother to one mission and sent her and her five-year-old sister, Frederique, to a place that local residents called the White Sisters, run by Catholic nuns in an area called Save in southern Rwanda. 3 years later, in 1959, the girls were flown to Belgium, where Gougebert was placed with a family of three in the coastal town of Blankenberg, in the Dutch-speaking part of the country. Frederique grew up with a family 80 miles away. According to Gougebert, the idea was that she would serve as a playmate to the couple's 12-year-old daughter. Only she never asked for a sister. When the two would go out together, her foster sister would be careful to walk several yards ahead. One night when Gougebert was nine, her 18-year-old foster sister came bounding into a room to tell her about how she'd fallen in love. "But you will never get that," the older girl said, "because you are black." "That was the first time," Gougebert said, "that I was aware there was a problem with me." For her part, Gougebert's foster sister does not recollect their past in the same way. "About our shared history, I don't recognize Jacquie's story at all." The now 67-year-old, who recounted her story over cappuccinos in a Brussels coffee shop, would later learn that her birth father had left money for her upbringing and education. But her foster family dispersed only meager amounts, telling Gujber, for example, that she didn't really need to eat meat and offering her sheets to rip up when she was menstruating. Her foster sister, meanwhile, was provided with store-bought tampons. One of the nuns at Gujber's Catholic high school told her she was lucky she wasn't a pig, because when pigs mix race, the babies are born with several colors. At the age of 18, having finally taken the birth certificate and other files that she discovered as an 11-year-old rifling through her foster father's office, Gujber left the family for good, matriculating at a university in Ghent. "You see a birth certificate," she said. "You see letters from nuns, but you don't understand. Really understanding, that is something very new for us." Perhaps more than any other imperial power, Belgium has resisted reckoning with its colonial past. For generations, its citizens seem to have alternated between maintaining a stony silence and outright glorifying life in the former colonies. A bronze statue of the horseman and Leopold still occupies a place of pride in central Brussels. One of the city's main routes, the Boulevard General Jacques, commemorates a man who, confronted with rebelling Congolese laborers, vowed absolute submission or complete extermination. A 2022 survey conducted by the University of Antwerp, Belgium's Africa Museum, found that out of 12 questions asked about the country's imperialism, respondents, who were representative of the national population, could answer on average just 4 correctly. Only 70% knew which king had taken possession of the Congo as a private state, and barely any could name the 3 African nations formerly under Belgian rule. The year 2008 marked a century since the Belgian state took direct control over Leopold's African holdings. Gujber, feeling offended by the media barrage celebrating that big, beautiful period of colonialism, decided she needed to do something. She would go on to co-found 2 organizations, Mixed 2010 and the Métis of Belgium Association, both dedicated to helping fellow Métis find community, raise awareness about their plight, and lobby the government to address their ongoing challenges. Because colonial agents had routinely changed the names of Métis toddlers and falsified documents so the children would be unable to track down their European fathers, many Métis continue to lack Belgian birth certificates and have been unable to gain Belgian citizenship. The logistical nightmare is only compounding a lifelong sense of rootlessness and alienation. When Gujber was 21, she flew back to Rwanda in hopes of finding her mother. Disembarking in Kigali, surrounded by black people, she remembers feeling disoriented and profoundly lonely. "I was used to white people," she said. Everyone that Gujber had told about her plans to return to Africa had warned her. "Be careful," they said. Sure enough, she said, when she arrived in the village where her mom was living, all the cliches they said would happen happened. She told me lies. She said, "I'm so lonely." And those who translated said, "Oh, she's not lonely. She has a husband here." And then she asked for money. Gujber's sister, Frederic, hadn't wanted Jacques to go in the first place. The older girl had been 5 when the two were taken away by the gendarmerie, and Frederic's memory was of a mother standing there motionless with a blank expression on her face. She hadn't even cried. Her idea was that she was a cold woman, says Gujber. "We were taught to think about our mothers as uncivilized, careless people." In 2014, after retrieving her sister's files from the government archives in Flanders, Frederic died of cancer 2 years later, Gujber learned that her mother had twice hidden her daughters from the police and that they were taken from her only on the 3rd attempt. However, the clarity came too late. Her mom and aunts had all been murdered in the 1994 genocide, which took the lives of several hundred thousand Tutsis over the course of 3 months. She learned of her mother's death previously from fellow Métisses. Bitu Bingi, who welcomed me into her home in a quiet town on the Flemish-speaking side of Belgium, once returned to her birth village, and she briefly reunited with her mother, who explained that she'd run off that night in 1953 because she couldn't bear to see her baby girl being taken away. Still, having lived apart for 2 decades, the feelings the two once had for each other never returned. This was a child of sin, Bitu Bingi's youngest daughter, Monique Fernandez offered as an explanation. They had already begun to break the love between the mother and the child. In the intervening years, Bitu Bingi's mother had married a Congolese man and given birth to other children. "You have to understand," Bitu Bingi said. "When you grow up without someone," she trailed off. Even today, Jacquie Gougebourg can't talk about her past with her two adult daughters. "That's one of the reasons why I started doing this work," she said, "because I knew I couldn't sit down with a child in front of me and tell them how much pain I have." Belgium finally has begun to confront the reality of its imperial past. In 2018, the Royal Museum for Central Africa, located in a Brussels suburb called Tervuren, reopened as the Africa Museum after a five-year overhaul aimed at undoing its longtime reputation as a bastion of colonial propaganda. Also that year, the country renamed a square in the capital city after Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, who was assassinated by political opponents with the complicity of the Belgian state in 1961. And thanks in large part to lobbying by Gougebourg and others, the Métis question has finally become the subject of national discussion. In March 2018, Belgium's Chamber of Representatives unanimously passed something called the Métis Resolution, mandating that the government find administrative solutions to the problems that continue to result from the segregation of Métis, who were victims under the Belgian colonial administration. A team of researchers has begun to sift through the thousands of documents hurriedly transported out of the Belgian Congo at independence and Rwanda-Urundi shortly thereafter. Likewise, it is reviewing documents kept by the Association for the Protection of Mulatres, the main organization responsible in the 1950s and 60s for placing mixed-race children with Belgian families. The materials are being entered into a database, which will allow researchers to assist survivors looking to learn about their identities and reconstruct their histories. The researchers have also created a virtual exhibition documenting stories of the Métis. The resolution, for which the state had already earmarked 1.9 million euros, also mandates that the government underwrite a comprehensive study of the Métis, exploring the role they played by Belgian authorities at the political, administrative, legal, and religious levels. It's really extraordinary that they adopted these resolutions that take these very strong engagements, says Delphine Lauwers, the archivist overseeing the project. This initiative is not just legal or social or historic. It's really a very vast question that traverses the entire period, all aspects of colonial life. Even given the considerable resources devoted to the project, says Lauwers, who has a PhD in history and has done history research on the Rwandan genocide tribunals, is proving exceptionally complex. Not only are there thousands of victims involved, but some of the files, particularly those linked to the Ministries of Defense and Foreign Affairs, the successor to colonial administration, remain inaccessible because of legal obstacles. And though the Belgian Catholic Church issued a statement in 2017 apologizing for the role it played in the abductions and asking Catholic institutions in Belgium, Africa, and Rome to make available all documents that might help survivors find their ancestry, they are technically private and logistically difficult to access. "I've had this bag for 40 years, Bitu Bingi says, setting down a black and gold striped canvas carryall on her dining room table. The soft-spoken mother of seven moved to this quaint village in 1981 after the death of her Congolese husband. I wanted my children to be people of the world, she said. A few years later, she traveled back to the mission in Katende and asked the mother superior, now a Congolese woman, for access to the school's old files. She was given the key to a rickety armoire, inside of which she found piles of old folders. I took everything, she said. She opened a faded blue exam book with the word Mulatresses written on the cover in neat cursive. At the top of the first page appears the date, September 1958, in the same careful hand. 23 names, including those of Bitu Bingi, Nagalula, and Tavares Muyinga, are listed underneath. Fernandez pulled out a feuille de route, or travel order, along with a road map and instructions on how to get to Katende. Among the documents Bitubingi collected was a 1953 telegram informing the nuns that an agent would be accompanying her friend, Nogalula, and her brothers to the school. L'enfant mulâtre Vendebroc Simon, it reads, né le 13/4/1950. Nogalula hadn't known her father's last name until Bitubingi returned from the Congo with the files. They didn't want to give me the name Vandenbroek, Nogalula said sadly. That's me, Bitubingi said, pointing to an impish-looking child in a group photograph. She's the one who punished me, she went on, singling out a nun and describing how once, after climbing a tree at the age of 8 or 9 to pick oranges, Bitubingi had been ordered to harvest habanero chilies every morning for a week. Repeatedly thrusting her throbbing fingers in and out of a bucket had done nothing to relieve the excruciating burning sensation that resulted. The bag also held some newer documents. Bitubingi pulled out a correspondence with Queen Fabiola from the year that she arrived in Belgium. I was really sure my queen was going to help me, because I had never asked her for anything, she said. Tavares Muyinga, who moved to Belgium from Congo in 1988, after the death of her mixed-race husband, also said that she'd written to the queen. I am here in Belgium, the red letter said. My husband is dead. I have 4 children. I could use a little help. Both women received replies on thick letterhead featuring a pink embossed crown that assured them the queen had read their letters. She referred them to the Public Centers for Social Assistance, Belgium's welfare administration. And we are going to pause that article today, and we will finish it on our next program. So like I've said, we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.